The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Hello, Zero Books viewers and readers. It's me, Douglas Lane. I'm here with Nina Power. Nina Power is the author of One Dimensional Woman, which is a book that was published by Zero Books way back in 2009. And she is a former academic and an author with many books and works in the works. Nina, how are you doing?
I'm good. It's funny. We've never actually talked before, even though I wrote for Zero Books ages ago. But then you moved in later on, in any case.
Right. But after your crew, I think of it as being your crew left, because you were pretty close to Mark Fisher. And I don't know about whether you knew Tariq very, very well, but I remember early days when I was starting, your book was selling well. It continues to sell well more than a decade later. And I was trying to figure out how to do publicity. And we had a conversation then where you were like, yeah, you know, why don't you try to be a little less edgy in the way you promote my book, I think was how that went. So my first interaction with you. It was like I had written about one. How was it again? I had written about One Dimensional Woman for BuzzFeed. I had written this BuzzFeed article, and you were like,
"Oh yeah."
You know, maybe the feminists don't hate me that much. You put a line in there where you're saying the feminists were up in arms about my book, and I don't remember the exact line because it was not quite that direct. And you're like, yeah, could you change that? And I did. It was no problem. But that was our first interaction.
I was trying to cancel you, Doug. No,
You weren't trying to cancel me. You were just trying to avoid being canceled. I think it was what it was.
But there's no point in trying to avoid that.
No, not anymore. I think back in 2015, it might have seemed possible to avoid. So I'm glad to get a chance to talk to you, and especially because, you know, you're actually, I think, along with Mark Fisher, one of the authors that put Zero Books on the map back in 2009. Your book did very well, and it sort of defined the trajectory of the more leftist side of the imprint. There was Graham Harman, who was philosophical and I would say kind of liberal. And then there was Mark Fisher, and there was you, and which was more had a Marxist tinge or more of a leftist tinge. So I'm glad to talk to you now because I think you're an important historical figure for the imprint, and that doesn't mean that you're just in the dustbin of history or anything. It just means you helped get the thing going. But I wanted to talk to you about some of your more recent work. Which I think falls in line after some of the work that Mark Fisher did, like in Ghosts of My Life. You've been writing about depression, and you had an essay called Depressive Suicidal Black Metal. Do you still think do you think depression is political in the way that Fisher did? And does that continue to be a subject of interest for you?
Yeah, I mean, so the context for the work you're talking about. So you're talking about an essay I wrote actually for a collection called Black Metal Rainbows, which is out next year from PM Press, mm-hmm. Edited by Daniel Lukes and Stanimir Panyotov. And this is part of a whole lot of work I was doing around men and masculinity, because I've just finished a book about men called What Do Men Want? For Penguin, which is looking at all of the kind of contemporary discussions around men and masculinity, much of which is obviously extremely critical of men and these ideas of toxic masculinity and so on. So I did quite a lot of research on male depression and male suicide rates, and also around incels. And I've written about incels recently as well, for The Spectator, and trying to, in a way, take seriously this question or this problem of male depression and male suicide, in particular, from a feminist approach, whatever that kind of means in a certain way, because I think too often there's a kind of zero-sum game going on, as if, you know, if women succeed in certain ways socially, that men lose, or that's the impression, or if men have power, then women are somehow kind of missing out. So I try to, perhaps rather paradoxically and impossibly, kind of take seriously everyone's complaint, like women's complaint about men and men's complaint about women, and try to put them together in a sort of reasonable way. And I think actually it's much more controversial to try to be reasonable these days than it is to try and be polemical. And I think in One Dimensional Woman, which is like obviously really old now, that was a kind of much younger person's book. It was a polemic, it was very short. And in a way, I think it's actually easier to write a polemic.
I can see that.
Whereas, take seriously, you know, people's pain, especially the pain of those who are at this point, you know, not supposed to have pain, or like whose pain doesn't matter, let's say. So like the idea of like impoverished white men in America, like suffering, you know, the idea of the incel. I mean, these are groups of men who are kind of, one is permitted to demonize in the current logic.
Right. Well, I have a question just about your title of your book. Freud, you know, famously wasn't sure what women wanted, right? But no one seems to be that confused about what men want. Do you think that it's more confusing than it's generally acknowledged?
Well, obviously, like One Dimensional Woman, the title is a joke about a book written by a man, or a claim by a man. Mm. So that's obviously the joke. What do men want is a direct reference to Freud, of course. No, I have a long list at the beginning of all the things that men have told me that they wanted, which range from like a shed to a beer to various sexual things, or to be left alone, or Nigella Lawson or whatever. Mm. And so... Yeah, I mean, like in a sense, the joke is like, of course, I don't know what men want, but the bigger joke is like nobody really knows what they want.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
But so it does seem that the stereotype is when it comes to relationships with women, that men are pretty obvious about what they want most of the time. It, you know, it's sexual, and that women are more of a mystery. Do you think that is? I mean, what is the right feminist approach to that question? Do feminists today want to claim that kind of assumption, that women are more of a mystery, that women are less direct in their desire, is itself sexist, or is a proper thing to do? How do I avoid getting canceled? I guess I'm asking you, this is maybe the mistake, but you don't know. I mean, do you feel that there's some validity to the idea that women are more mysterious and less direct in what they want from a romantic partner, or from men?
The horrible situation that we're in the kind of computer age is that in a way nobody is a mystery to anybody else, you know, that there's this kind of horrible flattening, you know, via the algorithm and dating apps. And, you know, in a sense, everybody like is telling everybody all the time who they are and what they want and how they identify and what they're into. And, you know, actually, it would be great if there was more mystery, because actually this kind of complete pornographic elimination of secrecy, you know, in the name of like information overload and, you know, is actually like not good. Like it's horrible, it's too transparent. Like there's a kind of Baudrillardian, you know, hyper pornographic after the orgy kind of explosion of you know, identity and signs, and actually a bit more mystery on both parts would be very good, I think. In the book, I basically say that we've kind of become like much more horizontal, in the sense that once you kind of go beyond a sort of patriarchal society in a certain sense, if there ever really was one, then there's a sense in which men and women are more like brothers and sisters, and it's a kind of question of like sibling rivalry, and that actually the problem is that we seem too similar to each other rather than different. And especially in a kind of consumer capitalist world in which, you know, how you differentiate yourself from somebody else is really rather marginal and minimal, hence why people are so obsessed with identity, because it's really very little actually at stake.
Well, I wanted to go to these questions I sent you at the outset. And the reason why is they provide me with some guideposts for the conversation so that I don't, so that I keep conflict going, because that's always a good way to keep an interview going. And so what I tried to do when I was reading your essay was figure out what kinds of orthodox Marxist Hegelian critiques I could launch at your essay. So with that in mind, I mean, I mean all the questions because these are the things that I kind of believe, but they're also the things that I really feel like I have to debate and, you know, try to develop. So I'm looking forward really to get your answers to these things, but and they're kind of theoretical. So in your essay on depressive suicidal black metal, you ask if there's a form of alienation that goes beyond the forms that Marx outlines. See, right away, my back is up. A form of alienation does not coincide with the fetishized nature of production under capitalism, but that is perhaps mystifying and primal. And my question to you is, why wouldn't this form of alienation be basically ideological or purely abstract, or isn't this kind of a form of idealism to look for or worry about that kind of alienation? Don't you risk naturalizing it, really something that's historically contingent, an historically contingent social problem, when you turn to asking about this supposedly deeper form of alienation that to me seems purely abstract?
I mean, on the contrary, I think the kind of depression that we're talking about when we're looking at depressive suicidal black metal, and just for context, so I wrote this essay and it's looking at, you know, male, this is a very male genre of metal, depressive suicidal black metal. And what I wanted to look at, there's a quote from this writer, anonymous writer called Zero H.P. Lovecraft, who's on Twitter and writes short stories. And he has this quote about this, a peculiarly or particularly male experience of the indifference and the apathy of the universe towards you. And what I was particularly interested in is whether there was a kind of a sort of sexuated difference, a sexual difference between the forms of depression that men and women suffer, and whether there was something kind of almost incomprehensible about this kind of blank indifference of the universe that H.P. Zero Lovecraft identifies with a certain kind of masculinity. And in that sense, I don't think, I mean, first of all, I don't think we have to restrict our discussion of alienation to Marx. I mean, it's already in Hegel, it's in Feuerbach too. It's not only a Marxist concept. And there are at least two different words for it in German in any case. What I was interested in this kind of absolutely like abyssal void-like alienation was this kind of cosmic alienation. And the forms of alienation that you have in Marx, I mean, typically the four kinds that usually get identified, alienation from labor, you know, the process, also from the product of your labor, alienation from your fellow man, and alienation from the species or species being, Gattensvesen, like a kind of total alienation from humanity, right? But in a sense, there is a deeper form of alienation, which is alienation that doesn't have anything to do with other humans or with labor, but with the cosmos, you know, and this idea of like being confronted with this absolute blank, indifferent void, you know, which you would read about in Thomas Ligotti and others, you know, that does seem to be much more kind of fundamental. And I think there's absolutely room to talk about this kind of cosmic form of alienation, particularly in relation to suicide, you know, which is not abstract at all, you know, and like the male suicide rate is extremely high. It's like the highest cause of death in men under 45 in the UK. It's, you know, it's a serious and practical problem. And whether we're talking about deaths of despair or, you know, deaths on the basis of a certain kind of like nihilism or a kind of collapse of status, or, you know, the many reasons why people commit suicide. And, you know, men and women, you know, by all accounts, attempt suicide at similar rates, but men are much more successful, often because the means they use to commit suicide are more violent, in a sense. And so I was trying to think about the precondition for the kinds of states of being in which one's fellow human or labor or, you know, being accepted into a certain kind of social world or being successful on the terms of this world would never be adequate. You know, so I don't think we need a purely, I think there is just this deeper question of alienation. I don't think it's ideological or abstract to reflect upon it.
Well, and this is, I think, our point of disagreement, and it's nicely abstract. So hopefully we can work on it together without, you know, either one of us trying to cancel the other. I think that's very possible. So here's my trouble, and really, you know, correct me if I'm miseducated on this, but it seems to me that our notion of what the cosmos is, or the nature of the universe, has historically developed, and you can see how our understanding of the cosmos historically changes as the social reality changes, as the basis of our production changes, as the kinds of relationships that set up the terms of society change. Certainly the notion of what the cosmos was in the feudal era is very different than the notion of the cosmos today. I think today we have a more nihilistic understanding of the cosmos, more of an understanding of the void as truly empty than we would have, in the 15th or 14th or centuries, say. And that what that points to for me is that our supposedly abstract ideas are always also a reflection of the real world relations that we've created in order to survive. That, you know, that's like part of Marx's critique of Feuerbach, is he says, you know, we project our best qualities onto heaven. God is a version of our own understanding of ourselves. That's true. But it also is alienated precisely in the same way that our society is alienated. So that there are different forms of alienation as we change the mode of production, or as we change the social relations that guide our everyday life. So that would be what I would come back to Thomas Ligotti especially with, is that his understanding of like this sort of ontological despair is actually historically produced, and is itself a symptom of a certain kind of freedom that he doesn't recognize.
Sure, but just because you're saying something like is historically contingent or things change over time, it doesn't mean that that kind of relation isn't real. I mean,
mean it's not real, but it means it's not deeper, right? It isn't deeper than the social if it's an epiphenomenon of the social.
Right, but I mean, I guess in that sense, I would disagree, and if that, you know, makes me sort of no longer a Marxist but some kind of, I don't know, naturalist or something, that's okay, I suppose.
Yes,
I mean,
absolutely, yeah. Go on. You know, we don't all have to be Marxists. It's just that's my little territory, right?
Yeah, but I do think there are concepts of nature in Marx. I mean, there's a very interesting book by Schmidt on the concept of nature in Marx, and I think it's something that if you focus too heavily on the social and the extent to which we accept the terms on which the world is presented to us, right, in this current social situation or the current political situation or the current mode of production, you know, it doesn't mean that that's the only way we can see things. I mean, even if one kind of has a relation to nature that is kind of, you know, ideologically suspect, let's say, it doesn't mean that's not kind of anything deeper than the political or what passes for the political. You know, then that's also a kind of real relation. And you know, I mean, there is no, you know, just because nature has been thoroughly socialized and just because the planet has been thoroughly anthropomorphized, or, you know, the idea of the Anthropocene or the Capitalocene, it doesn't mean that there isn't still nature. And I think this kind of fear and trepidation about talking about nature, whether it's human nature or non-human nature, is kind of part of the problem. I think people accept the terms, a very pessimistic, negative social description of like our social life, and which is in itself kind of completely politically inhibiting.
So someone is asking us if we're live or we're Memorex, and I hope that this will let them know that we are live. This is not a simulation, although there is a delay between when we talk and when they see it. So it could be, okay. So, look, I feel as though that the reason why there's a need or people are driven to hold on to certain kinds of concepts of nature is because of the anxiety that arises when you are operating in a world without a foundation, without an ontological kind of permanence that supports you, that we're very uncomfortable with our own freedom, sure. and for good reason, right? I mean, I think we may be the kinds of creatures that are just built with the need for a certain kind of authority in order to operate. Being able to make a reference to a natural order is psychologically helpful. So I don't want to just completely reject that idea, but I do want to maybe question what kinds of things that we conceive of as being natural and whether or not, I mean, I'm kind of Zizekian. I'm a Zizek fanboy. I feel as though there is a natural order, but what's most natural is maybe alienation or the incompleteness of nature or the gap that's in that we experience between ourselves and nature is what is the most natural part of existence, which is why we're free to develop historically rather than simply struggle to obtain a natural relation to the world and each other.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, nature is indifferent. I mean, I'm not saying nature is like lovely and good. I mean, you know, I'm quite Herzogian about this, like nature, you know, either doesn't care about you or wants you dead. You know, I don't think it's possible to trace a kind of natural order from the outside, as it were. But nevertheless, I think acknowledging that there is something called nature, that there is a thing called human nature, you know, is the basis for proceeding in a non-ideological and non-idiotic way. I think, you know, a lot of the time we've gone so far in our kind of distance from attempting to understand nature, or we accept the scientific picture of the world only, which is a kind of quantitative image in many ways, you know, that there's such trepidation about it. Like, you have to ask yourself, like, in any kind of ideological or theoretical moment, like, why and which terms are completely out of bounds, right? So at the moment it would be things like nature, essentialism, human nature, sexual difference, you know, all of these sorts of things. Like, these are like terms that people kind of make a real point of avoiding, saying, oh, you know, they're like the worst thing in the world. The worst thing in the world is to be an essentialist, right? Because the idea is that if you make a claim about something and you say what something really is, that therefore you're making a claim about how things should be. You know, if you say that men exist and they're this kind of being, then the implication is that then, you know, all men must be like this, or that some sort of behavior or, mm-hmm. Thing follows from that. And I don't think that's true. I think that suspicion is the problem, in a way. Then you end up with this kind of like just total hall of mirrors and symbolic catastrophe, where kind of words mean whatever you want, and you just you're in this kind of free floating, like free for all, in which you can say kind of anything about anything at all. And I think, you know, this is a kind of problem with the use of language. It's like we all have to collectively agree in a certain sense what words mean.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well. I think that given that you've written a book about what men want, and we started our conversation discussing the differences between men and women, and that it's a hot topic, hot button topic. We probably, out of all the essentialisms that we could possibly hone in on, let's talk about the essential difference between men and women as a sexual difference, and the fact that you feel, and I think you're right, that this is something that most people, especially on the left, want to deny, that there's a fundamental difference that can be reduced to a binary between men and women, and that difference is somehow fixed, whether it's fixed spiritually or biologically. But you would argue that that is a true difference that we can find in the world that's natural and that is not historically contingent.
Yeah. Right? I mean, the way in which one lives out one's life as a man or as a woman is historically contingent, right? And it is kind of individual. It's an existentialist project, like existence does precede essence in that sense, in the way in which we live our lives, right? But, it doesn't mean that there aren't men and aren't women. And also historically, if we want to talk about history, it would do an absolute injustice to the history of like women's struggle and feminism to say, this was just about a class of people who identified as women, but weren't actually, that word didn't really mean anything, given that women really didn't have a choice about it. Like, it wasn't a question of simply saying, oh, I'm not a woman, you can't treat me like that. Do you see what I mean? Like, there's an entire history of the world that gets kind of completely rewritten or cut out if we, change or abandon the use of those words in particular ways. And that's why I think that discussion about what those words mean has to be a kind of collective social discussion. If we decide that these things now mean something else, or they have a legal, they're transformed in law, it can't just be, an assertion that that's how it is, because of the implications for understanding the whole of human history, which up until 5 minutes ago, did have this working definitions, at least, and to say that there are men and there are women isn't to say, therefore, men and women should behave in these particular ways. Like, the, sure. Nothing follows from those facts. And if you look at second wave feminism, which I still think is an unfinished project, that's where I'm coming from with this. It's like, when we were growing up, it was like, just because you're a girl, it doesn't mean you can't do what you want, but there was an acknowledgement that there was a difference, that there were boys and girls, and that this had a kind of historical meaning. And the point about separating sex and gender for second wave feminism was to try to say, look, gender is the way in which sex is lived out. And often those gender roles were extremely oppressive. And in fact, we need to kind of abolish gender. And I think instead that kind of, not what happened. Like, it was going that direction, right? It was going in that way. And then something kind of changed, and gender suddenly became this thing that was an inner feeling as opposed to a kind of externally imposed social expectation. The meaning of the word changed. So I think there are at least two different competing notions.
Yeah, I think that the way that the gender changed from basically a socially imposed set of norms to an identity would be worth examining closely. And also, I also think that the externally imposed set of norms have always sort of shaped identity. So it's very difficult to cleanly delineate between the self-perception and the imposed norms. And I think that part of the struggle for people who are breaking gender norms is to, fight the enemy within their own head and discover where the enemy really is and where he or she isn't. I'm only imagining here, because I'm a typical male, according to Zizek. I want to show you a clip before we began the stream. You were kind enough to let me edit together and upload this clip so we could show it. So I'm going to show it now, and I just want to get your reaction to Zizek here.
I don't feel that I have a fixed sexual identity and so on. I agree.
Yeah, you said in the book, you when you see the sign ladies and gentlemen. Yeah,
usually I have problems. Women, as hysterical, are the mouth of truth. Because you know what's for Lacan, a woman's hysterical question? You women are much more interesting because this doubt about who I am is subjectivity at its purest. We men are more stupid. We usually believe what we are.
What do you think?
I take the point about identity completely. I mean, I think this is one of the issues. I mean, like, nobody is anything in that sense, right? Like, in terms of, you know, it's sort of madness to say, to assert constantly that one is X, like, I am X. You know, it doesn't correspond to the way in which life is a sort of series of becomings, if you like, or, you know, existentially one kind of lives in a sort of like strange and confusing flow and flux, and actually to try and arrest that in a certain way is a coping mechanism perhaps.
I feel like that the confusion about gender operates on a couple of levels, at least it seems to. One is that you can operate on the level of the individual in their own life, and you know, for some boys and men, it operates on the level of, am I masculine enough? Am I acting like a sissy? Am I a real man? That kind of thing. But also then on the level of society, the questions come up of like, what kinds of gender roles or even biological functions are important to understand masculinity or femininity? For me, the easy way that technology and social change influences our understanding of what it is to be a woman revolves around something like the invention of artificial wombs, where if those really get fully developed, and it looks like they will be, a lot of, you don't think so?
No, absolutely not.
Okay. Well, they have, you know, delivered lambs in artificial wombs, but you don't think that artificial wombs are in the future?
I think it's extremely unlikely. I think the level of cost and complexity of creating a human artificial womb is, and the, not to mention the ethical dimension, will be prohibitive. What you're much more likely to see, which we already see, is surrogacy and exploitation of women, and particularly in the developing world.
Well, why? So you're pretty sure that the technology itself will just require too much work and money to really take off. I mean, I don't know how we could calculate that. I guess it would be, there'd be a series of economic questions to ask. We'd have to know like what was required technologically. Is it more expensive ultimately to create an artificial womb than it is to create like a artificial set of lungs or artificial heart, or, you know,
it's extraordinarily complicated. I mean, just think about it for a second, what a womb is, you know, what that process of gestation is. I mean, it's like a moment's reflection would tell you that it's unbelievably complicated thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. But I mean, just to do, I'd have to look into it a little more. I'm not convinced, given that they've already developed an artificial womb that can bring a lamb to term, I am not convinced that it's completely outside the possibility that our future, let's say in 50 or 100 years, might include artificial wombs. I tend to be a techno-utopian in this regard, probably.
I'm very against that. You know, I mean, I'm.
You're morally against the idea, as well in practical terms.
But also in relation to the question of technology, I mean, I'm a kind of Luddite in a certain way. I mean, politically, I think, you know, I think technology is the problem. I don't think it's the solution to anything. I think we need to kind of like turn away from technology. I think it's absolutely like abhorrent in many ways. And I think
this is really fascinating. I want to tell you about a personal story very briefly. I told my wife that I thought that artificial wombs were going to be part of the future. And she says, well, men won't get laid anymore if that happens. Like, see where that gets you, guys. And I thought that was a very interesting and funny and unexpected response, that she was like threatening to lock knees at the prospect of artificial wombs being in the future. And I'm maybe saying more than I should about my wife, but I just thought that was an interesting response. So what do you think the source of that discomfort is? And you, I mean, it's not the same, but what is it about the idea of an artificial womb that seems so unnatural and off-putting?
I mean, I think it's a kind of part of a sort of Promethean, you know, technophilic desire. I mean, you could obviously, there are aspects of this in people like Julemyth Firestone, who talks about this in Dialectic of Sex. And there's I've written a critique of kind of that sort of technophilic feminism in the past. But I think, you know, what all of this kind of obsession with technology, artificial wombs, immortality, all of those sorts of ideas, is just a kind of like, what it reveals is an absence of tragedy, you know, an inability of our contemporary world to accept the fact that in a way life isn't fair, that things are unevenly distributed, that not everybody is sexually desirable, that not everybody can have children, you know, to turn everything into a kind of consumerist desire, like you want something, therefore you should have it. I mean, is the problem, you know, like this is, there's something kind of absolutely like repellent about that idea, you know, like not everybody gets what they want, you know, that's life, you know, and I think without a culture that deals with the tragic acceptance of life and its, you know, confusing and mortal dimensions, then we are already in a kind of like dystopian hell in which, you know, everybody proposes a technological solution to a problem caused by technology, and you end up in this Ouroboric kind of like surveillance fucking online hell that we're in, and like the pandemic will only be is only an opportunity for these things to be kind of like rolled out even further, and for everyone to be monitored, and for everything to be, you know, technologized.
We should talk about the pandemic as well. Maybe we'll have to, because there's going to be a conversation in the Patreon feed, or what I'm calling the Parrot Room, for odd reasons. And so maybe we can bring up that topic in the Parrot Room, the pandemic. But I just to stick with this idea that you can't always get what you want, and that we're denying the reality of the tragic. When we look to, let's say, like I interviewed Aubrey de Grey. Aubrey de Grey is the guy who's one of the big propagandists for longevity research. And it was an interesting conversation. On the one hand, I'm coming up on 50. I'm all for, you know, longevity drugs. I know it's selfish and probably juvenile, but that's my knee-jerk response. I did notice that he didn't have a capacity to take in questions about social meaning and what would happen if we had those kinds of longevity drugs. I just have confidence that neuroses and tragedy and absurdity would continue even if we lived for 1,000 years on average. Like, human beings would still find a way to be miserable. I'm pretty convinced. So I don't think that the tragic is under threat. And I feel as though, like, you know, this goes back to the idea that things are historically contingent. What can be tragic could shift in a world where we had more command and control over our biological processes and could repair our bodies more efficiently, that we wouldn't lose out on the fact that we're all going to die, even in those conditions. I want to hear what you have to say, because I feel like this is a passionate, you know, this is a good topic. It's a good divide to kind of explore.
Yeah, I mean, when I talk about the tragic, I mean, in a way, I'm talking about something deeper again. I mean, maybe this goes back to your initial kind of problem with the idea of like a cosmic alienation, or, you know, a discussion, you know, let's say a kind of non-permitted discussion of nature, like the idea that we don't have direct relation, we don't have direct access to nature in this ontological way, you know, I mean, which would be the kind of Marxist or social critique of that idea, you know. And I'm suggesting that I think you can. I think that there is a direct relation to nature, and of course this would be like almost like a psychotic position from the Lacanian point of view, you know, this idea of the real. But I think what I mean by the tragic is something deeper. Again, it's not simply the kind of everyday unhappiness. It's not just the neurotic kind of moaning. It's not, you know, this idea that, like, why would man want to live forever when he doesn't know what to do with himself on a Sunday afternoon? You know, it's not just that. It's something like, you know, an absolute kind of inability of our modern age to accept that things are unfair somehow, you know, and deeper than that. And that in fact, a culture that exists, if you think about the relationship of like tragedy and comedy for the Greeks and the way in which the gods and the myths kind of play out the kind of various possible forms of passion, emotion, desire, and all of those sorts of things that people feel and still feel, even in this very mediated kind of, you know, hyper-ironic, distantiated, semiotic soup nightmare world, you know, is a kind of like a feeling, a kind of, you know, that even if you don't go through that yourself, you live those feelings and those myths and those emotions through the stories, you know, and that the tragic in that sense, you know, a consumer culture tries to prevent or protect people from the tragic in a certain way, whilst simultaneously generating these kind of like infinite desires and this infinite amount of information and data and so on. But, you know, tragic acceptance is in a way also kind of funny. It's also comedic. It's also on the side of a certain like life in a way, a certain mode of being, which is deeply alive. Yeah, and I think, again, that's something that is existentially, like, I don't know, we think we want to be protected from those direct emotions and those direct experiences, but really there isn't anything else apart from those in the end.
Well, I always take I always make this move where I say, well, I think what we really want to be protected from is a lot of the consequences of our abstract logical ideas. But you know, the problem is you can just assert anything. And the trick is in the argumentation and also I think in the emotional resonance of arguments. So, you know, I definitely kind of understand and connect to everything that you're saying, especially when it comes down to this notion that we need to accept that life is unfair. And I think, as someone who's embraced Marxism over the last 12 years or so, the way I've come to understand the Marxist project is one in which we're going to try to fail and create unfair and problematic conditions on a higher level. It's not so much that we expect life to be fair, but just that we're like, okay, we can clearly see in which the way we organize our lives now leads to these contradictions and problems where the unfairness is existential for many, many people, you know, for millions and millions of people, and in which we pretend that our own relations and the way we go about making the world is a natural process where we refuse the responsibility of our own to take responsibility for our own mistakes and own problems by naturalizing a mode of life and having it take place kind of behind our backs. So the role for Marxists is to get the working class particularly to take responsibility for itself and to give them the opportunity to create something that will be catastrophic in a different way, perhaps on the register of what do you do with yourself on a Sunday afternoon, rather than, you know, do you risk getting a toxic blood problem from raiding the dump to find what you need to sell for scrap to get the food to feed your family. You know, that's the problem you don't want. And the problem you do want is, how do you deal with too long a life? Or is there such a thing as having too long a life?
I mean, just, you know, accepting that things are unfair doesn't mean that therefore you shouldn't do anything about it, right? It's to understand injustice is not necessarily to accept injustice, right? It's certainly not collectively. I mean, you know, my understanding and my thinking about communism is in relation to questions of free time. you know, and a liberation from these forms of exploitation, you know. And I mean, of course, it's like this, you know, it's a kind of, you know, the question of redistribution is maybe in a way almost secondary in a certain sense. I'm very interested in what it might mean to like communize beauty, for example. What does it mean to have an experience of beauty? Beauty is something that's sort of typically thought of as hierarchical and kind of exclusive and oppressive, and, you know, that we're dominated by particular images of beauty. But in a sense, like, beauty is everywhere. Beauty is in the park. Beauty is in the streets. I mean, this is a 68 slogan that's not necessarily one of the ones that's picked up on the most in a way. And there's something about, you know, that kind of redistribution of the passions and of the visual and of the sensory that I'm very interested in. I don't like, I suppose, the you know, mechanistic replication of capital in certain images of communism. You know, I'm interested in the kind of polyvalent Marx, the Marx of the German ideology, in which all of those potentialities of humanity, of the social individual, can be explored and expressed. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not interested in replicating like automative, you know, mechanical, machinic images of the social or the political. That's where danger is. That's where, you know, freedom is killed. You know, so my image of freedom in relation to communism is yeah, precisely this idea of free time, of yeah, deciding what to do with time collectively and individually.
Well, Nina, we've talked for 45 minutes now, 46 minutes. There's people in the comments stream. What I think we should do is, if you're willing, is continue this conversation both in another section for patrons, but also maybe in the future, because I feel like we're just scratching the surface of maybe a productive disagreement. If you're interested in doing that, I'd be interested in having you back to do that. But do we want to take, why don't we ask if people in the comment section want to ask maybe one or two questions?
Where is the comments?
There's a button on the side that says comments. And do you see it on the right side?
No? Oh, yeah. Oh, there you go. Oh, my God, there's loads of them. I miss all of these.
Yeah. We've got about 210 people watching, and there's a whole lot of comments. And people are saying things like, I'm a postmodern. That's. If I could send you to the gulag, I would, whoever you are. Let's see. People are saying, let's see here. Nina. So there's a lots of comments, but if you know what would be great is if someone wanted to give us a super chat and ask a question, I would be certainly thrilled. But if you just want to ask a question, that'd be cool as well. Why don't we wait for a question? Go ahead.
I have a lobster dress. I should have worn it, man. There's all this lobster.
Here's a question. Let's see. Yeah, they should choose what they want to be and how. No, that's not really a question for us. It's just back and forth. I just saw a question mark and flashed it on the screen there. So why don't we tell people what we might talk about in the Parrot Room? And I figure we'll take a 10-minute break. If you're still up for doing a second session, are you? Would that be all right with you? Or are you feeling worn out? Okay. So I thought we'd talk about your cancellation and the problems that are going on the left around political and philosophical disagreements and some of the drama. That's I always like to put that in what I call the Parrot Room, because it's for a smaller audience, so you can be more free to talk. And also, it's what everyone really wants is the drama. And so to get their Patreon money, I put that stuff there.
Let's use gossip.
Yeah, explain the connection between sex and gender in 30 seconds or less.
Okay. And,
go ahead.
Sex is a fact. Sex is biologically real. Gender is a social construct and should be abolished. Men and women should be free to live and dress and do whatever they want and love whoever they want.
All right. That's good. Let's see.
Someone's That's just saying, wave position, by the way. That's a second wave feminist position. I really dislike the idea that we're suddenly supposed to forget about all of the insights of the second wave. You know, and the idea that it's controversial to repeat claims that were like actually filtering down into everyday life. And certainly when I was at school, the idea that we're supposed to like memory hole that idea of gender, I think is really, really alarming. You know, I think it's really suspicious.
You know, from my experiences on the left is a lot of people who are even consider themselves to be transgender activists would agree that gender is a social construct, that gender is a set of normative expectations. And they would also say, though, they would add on, gender is an identity. Then it gets muddy around the question of the relationship between gender as an identity and gender and sex as a biological reality. And there's I think that there's a parallel to this, that there was in the 90s, there was a parallel to what we're experiencing now, where the gay community wanted to really find a biological reason for homosexuality. They wanted to deny that there could be any psychosocial causes or influences on one's sexual orientation. And the reason why was because they then would no longer have to make a political case for their right to choose to have a gay lifestyle. It could be, they could be given a kind of legal protection based on being a class that was just a natural fact, rather than trying to struggle for a positive right, I think. And I think the same thing's true with transgender people today, that there's a that they're out of a kind of a conservative reaction and a rightfully earned sense of fear, that they retreat into a framework which they need not retreat into ultimately, but for political reasons. What do you think about that idea?
I think the whole discussion has kind of unfortunately become very difficult in a way that it didn't need to become. And I think this is like one of the tragic things that's happened in the discussion over the last, I don't know, 5-8 years about this, at least maybe. I think this idea of like, you know, couldn't we all together discuss what these things mean and kind of negotiate terms? You know, I think the idea of like imposing changed meanings is going to backfire. I think it doesn't work to prevent people from asking questions or asking what the implications of certain major changes are going to be. And I think, you know, a lot of people have been really unduly punished for asking questions about this. And, you know, I just don't think that, you know, where the violence and the threat and the dangers lie, you know, it's like, it's men who overwhelmingly commit the vast majority of interpersonal physical violence, you know, firstly against themselves, secondly against each other, you know, and then against women and trans women, you know. But it's not cis women attacking trans women physically, you know, but that yet they are the kind of ones who tend to get kind of economically and socially punished for any discussion of this question about what it means to be a woman, you know. And in terms of free speech and, you know, anti-censorship, you know, when you have women getting kind of questioned by the police for tweeting and stuff, you know, this is like a really bad scene, man.
Yeah, this is a British problem more than it's a US problem, I think, that the police are coming after people for what they tweet. I don't see that happening quite as much in the United States because of our constitutional protection of free speech. It seems less likely to happen here on that level, although it happens on a corporate level, on social level, even more strongly here.
The platforms are basically acting like, you know, censors. I mean, of course they are. They're banning whoever they want. I mean, it's just because it's not the state doing it. I mean, it's kind of like usually in collusion, I think. You know,
I'd rather get kicked off Facebook, though, than have the cops come to my door and threaten to take me to the police station for something I tweeted or said on a live stream. So I got a nice donation here that I missed. So I'll put this up. And I think this may be our next, second to last, the penultimate question. I grew up with a Marxist father and mother, fairly well off. Mother is an attorney. Went to law school and studied philosophy too. I find it difficult to participate in a society I have critiqued my whole life. Help.
Take up. Yeah, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading Christopher Lash last night, and he talked about how in the mid-20th century, some people on the left confessed that the reason they got involved in communism was because it helped them overcome the crushing feeling of defeat they had around personal issues in their own life. And I had to say to myself, yeah, I see some of myself in that, especially when I look back to my 20s, when I first got really interested in being part of the far left. It certainly did have a compensatory role, as you know, I could be a strong at the time anarchist, but I couldn't make my way through you know, a normal dinner party. So I would just say that that there's nothing morally suspect about taking care of yourself on the level you need to in order to survive on a daily basis in this society, and that you shouldn't be a purist about the kinds of advice that you take if you're struggling personally. Like, it's just fine to start maybe being to taking religious ideas seriously if you're going through AA, for instance. Sure. I would allow yourself to be practical that way. What do you think, Nina?
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I think, like, life is hard and confusing and everybody suffers, you know, like, it's not a zero sum game. It's not like only some people's suffering matters. I mean, unfortunately, like, there's a kind of politics which seems to suggest that some people's suffering matters more than others, but, you know, it really doesn't. Like, everybody suffers. Like, life doesn't make a lot of sense and is confusing and unfair. And I think, yeah, I mean, you know, I guess it, like, personally speaking, the kind of leftist approach, let's say, to kind of mental health and addiction was not particularly helpful in a certain sense, because it had an explanatory value. It's like, well, of course, capitalism makes everybody feel terrible, and it's no wonder that people turn to, you know, addictive substances or have poor mental health. But actually, there's an image of the self that's kind of buried in that approach, which isn't necessarily, at least personally speaking, the most useful one in terms of actually, like, changing your life, which is also possible, believe it or not. it is possible. And surprising things happen. You know, this is another thing. And, you know, one should stay alive, if only for the surprise value, something I've learned. That, yeah, I don't know. Like, it's a very complicated question about what the self is and how one takes care of it. And of course, we're surrounded also by industries that are constantly telling you to put things in yourself, like donuts and have a bubble bath or something. And, you know, that's self-care. But I mean, of course, it's just shit.
Self-care is buying the right soap, I guess. Yeah.
You know, I found going outside was like the best thing I could possibly have imagined when I got sober. It was like, you know, this revelation of nature and health and, you know, that it was possible to do that. It's really simple. And I suppose it's like these incredibly simple things, like talking to a friend and being in the sun and being outside. And in a way, like, my paranoia and suspicion about the technology is about mediation. It's about those things being taken away from us, like those direct experiences, you know, the encounter with the outside and with the sun in a Bataillon way, if you so please, and you know, meeting a friend in person. I mean, now in you know, technically we're not allowed to meet somebody we don't live with, right, in London and in other parts of the country. Like, they're really serious restrictions, you know, and yeah, these are kind of deep human things, and it, you know, we are kind of being transformed and put into new modes of being, which are highly, highly technologized, surveilled, mediated, and so on, which you know, turn people away from those incredibly simple pleasures and delights that are, you know, what make us human.
Well, okay, I think that's a perfect spot to end this part of the conversation on, and you know, you made me feel a little guilty for never going on a walk without my podcast going in my ear. Like, maybe I should take those out and like just experience the world around me. Although these days the world around me is empty streets and a sense of paranoia. But yeah, thanks, Nina. We'll continue. So let's take a 10-minute break maybe, and then do another live stream if that's okay with you.
Sure.
All right.